It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I am Rob Ferret. Scott Walker, Wisconsin governor, is, as we speak, announcing that he is dropping out of the race for president of the United States. After an early strong start in Iowa polls, the governor has declined in polls, raising concerns about fundraising, earning less than one half of 1% support among registered Republicans in the most recent survey. Joining us now to talk about the announcement, we have Mike Wagner, Associate Professor for the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess the big question is, people were talking that this might happen sometime. He's announcing that he's suspending his campaign. Your read, why now?
Well, I think it's pretty stunning that he is not going to be going on and competing in the first elections, especially the Iowa caucuses. And so I suspect that what's happened is his plummeting in the polls has made his donors very nervous. It might have made some campaign staff nervous and potentially wondering what's next. It also probably influenced some of the people who had endorsed him already to rethink whether they were going to keep those commitments. And so some, you know, configuration of those elements probably worked together to cause him to drop out very early. And given the, his early status as a top-tier candidate, this is a pretty stunning and fast fall.
And, Mike, we're seeing the word suspend used here, some attributing to Governor Walker that he will suspend his campaign, other language dropping out. Which is it, or does it amount to the same thing?
Usually the suspending phrase, Rick Perry used the same phrase when he ended his campaign recently as well, is more technical in nature. So candidates can keep raising money to pay off campaign debt, and they can also hang around. So, if lots of other candidates all have stunning failures or have, terrible revelations come out about them, you can always hop back in. But for all intents and purposes, the race is over for Governor Walker.
This is a precipitous drop in not that much time for the governor.
Right.
Have we seen a drop like that in polling? I mean, obviously we've seen it, but over longer periods, have we seen something this sudden before?
We haven't seen it with someone that has Governor Walker's qualifications. We've seen it with Herman Cain, for example, in 2012. We've seen it with folks where people have around the country have no idea who someone is. They get introduced, they sound fresh, they pop up in the polls for a while, and then their lack of experience causes them to make lots of mistakes and they go away, such as like Cain did. Governor Walker was a known commodity. He'd won 3 statewide races in Wisconsin. He built a national fundraising base during the recall election. He is not someone who on paper is the kind of person who should pop up in the polls and then disappear just as quickly as he was there, but it happened, which is not a positive commentary on the quality of his campaign.
Is it fair to call this a decision based also on the money, that if the governor had had the funding to continue on through Iowa, he would have done so, but because some donors were leaving the pack, that's what it amounts to, a kind of a numbers game in that sense?
Yeah, there is an invisible primary that started several months ago and really continues through the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary, where candidates need to raise lots of money from donors. They need their super PACs to be able to raise lots of money, and that money needs to be used in the campaign for television commercials, paying staff, travel, and in the super PAC mostly for television commercials. And given the fact that Walker had a national donor base, it's surprising that they found themselves in a position where he didn't have the kind of money to continue. And so it's peculiar that the governor is out this early.
We're talking to Mike Wagner from UW-Madison, from the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, a political observer, talking about Governor Scott Walker's announcement today that he is suspending his campaign for president. We'll give a listen now to Governor Walker making that announcement. Here's a bit of that speech from just a few minutes ago.
Today, I believe that I'm being called to lead by helping to clear the field in this race so that a positive conservative message can rise to the top of the field. With this in mind, I will suspend my campaign immediately.
And in that speech, he was saying, hey, this is too rancorous. There's too much anger in this presidential race. And we saw that some, didn't we, Mike, in the debate, the second debate. People saw a lot of people taking jabs at each other, and maybe Governor Walker not as willing to enter the fray as directly as others.
Well, I don't know that it was the case that he wasn't willing to enter the fray. He was really one of the first to take a shot at Donald Trump in the debate. It's just that Trump shut him down almost immediately. And so I don't know that Governor Walker was, you know, not trying to take on other candidates. He certainly tried to zing Donald Trump by calling him an apprentice, you know, candidate, you know, things like that. And so, you know, when candidates say things like, I'm dropping out so that things can stay more positive, I think that's really code for I didn't have the money or the support in the polls to carry on. You know, Governor Walker had not campaigned by attacking other candidates. So it's true, I think it's fair to say that as he was on the campaign trail, he wasn't doing a lot of attacking of other Republicans in the race. He was certainly happy to attack Hillary Clinton, as most of the other Republicans are. But in the debate, he went after Trump, you know, in one of the more aggressive ways. It just it kind of landed with a thud in the debate and in the public reaction to it afterwards.
Mike, thanks a lot for talking. We're going to come back to you in a little bit. We're speaking right now with UW-Madison Associate Professor Mike Wagner, talking about Scott Walker's announcement today during which he suspended, dropped out of the 2016 presidential campaign. And we move now to WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson, who is there at the Edgewater for this announcement. Sean, hi and welcome.
Hey, Veronica.
Well, Sean, what did you see? What was the scene like at the Edgewater?
I was sort of surreal. I mean, it's imagine that a couple months ago, give or take a few days, and we were talking from a much different location in Waukesha, where thousands of people were gathered excitedly listening to Scott Walker kick off his campaign. It was very quiet here. It was all reporters, pretty much no sound as the governor made his way into the room. At 5 o'clock, you did have a cacophony of TV live shots speaking over one another, but the governor came in. His remarks were, you know, very brief, and as soon as he had finished them, he left the room. But the point that he made was that you know, he feels that people are called to leadership in different ways, and he said that he had been called to drop out of the field to clear the field, I guess was his wording, and he was calling on other people to do the same.
Sean, when did you and other people covering the Capitol and covering the governor first get wind that something big was happening today?
A couple hours ago for me. I think the New York Times was the first to report it. You know, the signs were there that he was in trouble. It was getting pretty hard to imagine a scenario where he was going to pull out of this and kind of right this ship. But he was just in Bloomberg this morning talking about how he was going to be making, you know, 10 appearances or more in Iowa every month, and that the voters there would get to know them the way that they know their own governor. So that was this morning. You know, just a few days ago, he was talking about doubling down on Iowa. And clearly, he recognized that there was no way for him to do this.
And, Sean, it sounds as though at this announcement that the governor evoked Ronald Reagan and said that the way that the race was going right now, it did not reflect the spirit of Reagan's optimism. What do you think about him bringing up Reagan on this day, the day that he drops out?
It is very common for Scott Walker to bring up Ronald Reagan in a speech, so that's not a huge surprise. And he also brought up one of his favorite lines that he's delivered not only in this race but in his race for governor. I think I remember him talking about it in toward the end of his recall race. People want to know, you know, if you want candidates who are for something. He said that that's not the way that this campaign is going right now, but you know, that's spoken from a perspective of somebody who's seen his support just evaporate. You know, a couple months ago he was the front runner in Iowa, undisputed, and this last poll that came out, a national poll, showed that nobody was inclined to vote for him.
Well, in his brief speech today, Governor Walker became the second after Rick Perry of the major candidates to drop out, and Governor Walker says, hey, I hope I'm not the last to do this, and soon.
I encourage other Republican presidential candidates to consider doing the same, so that the voters can focus on a limited number of candidates who can offer a positive, conservative alternative to the current front runner.
The current front runner, of course, Donald Trump. So did he say at any point Donald Trump's name specifically, Sean?
He did not. He did not. I think, you know, I would imagine Skywalker is probably going to try to use this to, you know, rebuild political capital. He's certainly lacking that right now. But if he can be kind of a voice out there, sort of the anti-Trump voice, speaking on behalf of the establishment of the Republican Party, it could do him some good. But, you know, it's going to be hard. It's going to be a hard case for him to make to other candidates who aren't in the same, you know, position that he is in the polls, where they can say, hey, I still have a plausible shot at this.
We're talking about Governor Walker's announcement today that he's dropping out of this presidential race, suspending his campaign. We've got Sean Johnson, WPR State Government Reporter. Mike Wagner stays with us from the UW-Madison.
We have breaking news right now. We are covering the announcement, fresh off the presses at 5 o'clock, that Governor Scott Walker is dropping out of the presidential campaign. We're getting reaction to that from Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter, who was at the scene. A lot of press there, not a lot of other people, in stark contrast to his announcement back in July. And Sean, did the governor give any indication about what's next for him?
No, not really. I mean, that's a natural question. People were kind of talking about this campaign. If he pursued it as he was pursuing it, it certainly didn't seem likely that he was going to want to stick around in the governor's office, or at least, you know, run for another term. And there were rumors that, you know, he might potentially step out of the way and leave office and let Rebecca Clathier's lieutenant governor take over. Again, that was just a rumor. It's not based on a reported fact or anything, but this is what the chatter was while the campaign was still happening. So with his early exit from the campaign, I don't know how that changes the metric. I mean, he has not been in Wisconsin to, you know, help his own cause here. And he's seen his Wisconsin poll numbers drop to the lowest level they've been, during his administration. So will we start seeing more of Scott Walker in Wisconsin talking about, you know, his budget, for example, or talking about policies at the state level? Or are we going to see him as sort of a talking head on the national networks as, you know, maybe that establishment voice that's out there saying, you know, Donald Trump, we got to get you out of here. You're not the answer for Republicans.
Well, Sean, we'll be watching that along with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter. He was at the Edgewater in Madison, where Governor Scott Walker made the announcement that he is dropping out of the 2016 presidential race.
We'll bring Mike Wagner back, associate professor at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, earlier we heard Governor Walker encouraging other candidates to do the same, clear the field, and have a more credible opponent to the front runner, who he didn't name, but who is Donald Trump. Do you foresee other candidates following suit anytime soon?
Usually candidates who stay in the race don't take their marching orders from those who've left the race, so I don't know that that'll happen. I imagine there is pressure within the Republican Party to start to coalesce around two or three strong options, or most likely options, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, maybe John Kasich or Ted Cruz, but Jeb and Rubio are kind of the establishment candidates, you know, the ones with the best chance to win. And I wouldn't be surprised if the party was starting to pressure folks who are polling poorly and raising money poorly and are lacking in endorsements to start thinking about a way out.
I'm like, I was just glancing through Twitter as we were listening to the news there a little bit, and some commentators already, you know, diverse array of opinions out there, but some saying that this was a mistake to drop out this early. Now, if it's a fundraising issue and the campaign can't go on, it can't go on. But is there a chance that for the Walker campaign, this was a tactical error, that anything could happen between now and that Iowa caucus?
Yeah, I hesitate to speculate, not knowing his financial bottom line is right now, what donors have told him or what people who've endorsed him have told him. But unless, you know, the money was hemorrhaging and his endorsers were about to walk away, you know, this is traditionally too early for a credible candidate to walk away. And so it's very surprising that he's packing it in right now, knowing what we know now. If we learn later that his donors were abandoning him, or the people who had endorsed him in Iowa especially and around the country were going to walk back those endorsements, then maybe it makes a little more sense. But, you know, Mitt Romney wasn't at the top of the polls at this time in 2012. You know, seven different people, I think, at least led a poll in Iowa, and none of them ended up winning Iowa on the Republican side in 2012. And so it's very early for this to be happening, which, you know, suggests that there's some reporting to be done about Governor Walker's decision today.
In addition to calling on other candidates to drop out of the race, Governor Walker had a message for the Republican Party in general in his brief address today.
In the end, I believe that the voters want to be for something and not against someone. Instead of talking about how bad things are, we want to hear how we can make them better for everyone.
So that's his vision for what he wants to hear from the Republican Party. Do you think that's a vision anybody's going to pick up and run with?
Well, I imagine, you know, most candidates who are running will at least have some element of their campaign talking about what they're for. Usually, when there's a front runner, they become the target of attacks from people who are not the front runner. We're starting to see more and more people go after Donald Trump. But, you know, we're going to start hearing more people say what they're for, and it will get easier for them to do that the fewer people who are running. It's really hard to get media attention when there's 17 people in the race, and now a couple have dropped out. And as more drop out, it'll be easier to get attention, because it's difficult to get attention when Donald Trump is one of the people running.
Now that Scott Walker has dropped out of the race, do you expect him to still have a presence as maybe a, not an official commentator in the national networks, but as a voice that the media turns to for their opinions as the race takes twists and turns? Will we still expect to hear him to be a presence?
I don't think he'll be much of a presence short of a decision to endorse someone in the near future. I imagine that once the party has figured out who their nominee is going to be, his name might surface in vice presidential speculation. You know, some people I've seen today have suggested that his style of his exit, you know, saying he wants to be for something and not against something, he wants to clear the decks for the party to, you know, move beyond the front runner, who is Donald Trump. Those might be things that you do if you're angling for a vice presidential position, or if you have designs on running for national office again sometime in the future. And so, you know, but I don't expect him to be a go-to person, you know, so long as he keeps his job as governor. I don't expect him to be a go-to person on the talk circuit.
I know we can't really get into alternate history too much, but do you think in a 2016 campaign without Donald Trump, Scott Walker might have been better able to sustain that initial momentum that he had had?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, sans Trump, he would have been a person who got a lot more attention early on. He gave a speech in Iowa that was fairly well received. He had some good polling after that. He probably would have gotten more attention had Trump not entered the race shortly thereafter. And so that's part of it. But, you know, if you're a talented politician, you figure out how to run against people who are beating you in the polls, and that's just not something that the Walker campaign was able to do this time. He's, you know, shown political skill in his other victories in Wisconsin, but the presidential campaign never really recovered from what started as a slow drop and then became a quick drop in the last few weeks.
Mike, how do you frame this run of Scott Walker's? Is this something that politicos will look at and say, this was a respectable run and something to be proud of, or is this more like a defeat that's something that a politician would try to run from?
I don't think that when the history is written of this campaign, there'll be much positive written about it. He peaked very early after a speech in Iowa, and since then he never really captured the attention of the news media. He never captured the attention of Republican primary voters in a sustained way. He was fine, but not, you know, outstanding in the first debate, and was really a non-entity for the last 2 hours of the second debate. It's not his fault that they didn't call on him, but he really didn't make much of a splash beyond some speeches, you know, really several months ago, and he was doing a lot of the work that campaigns that have a chance to do or have a chance to win were doing. You know, he was building endorsements, he was hiring staff in Iowa and New Hampshire, he was raising money, and these are the things that, you know, campaigns that have the best chance to win usually do, but something was missing, and I'm not sure if the money dried up or endorsers were going to walk away, or what the decision-making calculus was here for the governor, but he dropped quickly in the polls and was not able to find a way to recover.
Sean Johnson, let us know that Governor Walker didn't give a lot of indications of what is next for him now. What are you going to be looking for the future career of Governor Scott Walker?
Well, first he'll return, back home to Wisconsin, and, he has a term to finish out that he was elected to do, and he's not term limited. So he, should he decide to fill out his term, he may run again. He may not. He might look at the upcoming Senate seat in a couple of years if he has designs on a political future. There's still the possibility that he could end up as a vice presidential candidate on the Republican side. You know, Joe Biden was not, stunning the electorate in the 2008 Democratic primaries when he dropped out, and he ended up being Barack Obama's nominee. And so there are lots of possibilities for Governor Walker, and it'll probably be up to him which of those he pursues.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was UW-Madison Associate Professor Mike Wagner breaking down Scott Walker's announcement today, during which he suspended his 2016 presidential campaign.
For more coverage of Governor Walker's announcement, join Joy Cardine tomorrow morning from 7 to 8 a.m.
In new national survey results out today, researchers tried to figure out how widespread campus sexual assault is and what the climate is like on campuses surrounding issues of rape, sexual harassment, partner violence, and more. The survey collected information from 27 campuses around the country.
The UW-Madison was one of the schools taking part in the Campus Climate Survey on Sexual Assault and Sexual Misconduct, organized by the Association of American Universities. At UW-Madison and around the country, about one in four undergraduate women who responded to that survey reported that they had experienced sexual assault.
Dr. Sarah Van Orman joins us now. She's the Executive Director of University Health Services at UW-Madison and chair of a task force managing the survey. Dr. Van Orman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and thanks for discussing this really important topic.
Well, first of all, what kinds of things was the survey trying to find out?
So there were really three things that the survey was looking at. One, it wanted to be able to look at what was the prevalence of these different kinds of sexual violence on our campuses. They also wanted to get information about what students thought about the climate, what were their feelings about what was happening, and finally to ask students about what their knowledge about student campus resources were and procedures for responding. So those are really kind of the three big components of the survey.
Now, in terms of the results themselves, we've been seeing statistics maybe similar to these, but what seems especially unusual about this is just the scope of the data that came in. Tell us about how that compares to the data we've had so far.
Certainly, the 1 in 4, 1 in 5 number that's been used many times has been found on other surveys in the past, and there are differences between the AAU survey and previous surveys. But what was unique about this was the large number of campuses that participated and the large number of students that participated. So previous surveys had either been on a small number of students at a large number of campuses or 1 or 2 campuses. This survey really was unique in that it was all students on many campuses, and it allowed us to get much more information, particularly about how students' experiences differed on campuses, and also differences in the kinds of sexual assault and misconduct they were experiencing, and then also differences between the experience of various different types of students. So this is really valuable, unique information.
Now, this comes in the midst of a national conversation about sexual assault on college campuses. How does this new information fit into the picture of what we already have, what we think we know from current research?
You know, I think it really confirms much of what we know, that this is an extremely prevalent concern. It also confirms that why this is something that institutions of higher education pay attention to. One of the questions in the survey asked about what consequences the students had experienced, and it gave them a choice between things like academic consequences, physical, emotional. And academic consequences was one of the most common things that students reported, with over 50% of students indicating that that had been an adverse outcome. So we think about why institutions of higher education take this on. There's lots of reasons, but essentially what the students are telling us is this is keeping them from getting an education.
Now, I want to get into the numbers here at the UW. Now, as we mentioned, you've said the 1 in 4 undergraduate women who responded to the survey, again, this was sent to all the students on campus, they say they experienced some form of sexual assault. Does that fit in, again, with what you've seen, and how does that compare to the national numbers that came back?
Yeah, so what the 1 in 4, or 27.6% of our female undergraduates, indicated that since they had been enrolled here, they had experienced a sexual assault involving being physically forced or while they were incapacitated. And sexual assault includes penetration, attempted penetration, as well as other things like sexual touching and other kinds of assault. That number is actually slightly higher than what the national average on the survey was, which was right around 23%, but very much keeping in line with what other campuses found.
We're talking right now with Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of UW-Madison's University Health Services, and we're looking at a new national report on sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses, in particular right now at the UW. And alcohol is a factor that often gets linked to sexual assault. How did that link play out here at the UW?
Yeah, so alcohol is a very, what we would say about this is the common factor in sexual assault. And I want to be absolutely clear that consuming alcohol or being incapacitated is no reason, no one deserves to experience a sexual assault. We want to focus the alcohol issue, which has historically been focused on the victim. We want to change that to how alcohol affects the bystanders and affects perpetrators. What we know is that our students told us that students who had experienced a sexual assault, over 70% of them on our campus, the offender had been drinking. We know that also that alcohol is commonly used as a way for offenders to make their victims less able to defend themselves. And finally, we know that alcohol changes the ability of bystanders to recognize dangerous situations. For example, in one of our campuses, it asked students if they had witnessed someone, a drunk person or someone who was incapacitated, heading for a sexual encounter. And over half of our students indicated that they had seen that, significantly higher, actually, than the national average. But many of them really were not able to or didn't know what they needed to do to intervene.
Now, you said significantly higher than the national average here in Wisconsin at UW. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we certainly know that alcohol, high-risk alcohol use is a challenge on our campus, like it is many institutions of higher education, and something that we work on. But our high-risk alcohol consumption among our students and our undergraduates are higher than what we see nationally. So it's not a number that surprises us, but it definitely is a number that really gives credence to some of the work that we've been doing to reduce that among our undergraduates.
Now, there are programs that all incoming students have to go through. One involves being educated about consent and sexual assault and all of those things. Is alcohol part of that education process that students go through now, considering the link and considering the strength of those numbers here at the UW?
Yeah, so there's two mandatory programs that all incoming undergraduates are required to participate in. The first is called Tonight, and Tonight is our sexual assault and dating violence program. It includes information about not only resources and reporting, how to respond to a friend, what consent is, but also helps students learn to recognize how to be a good bystander. And some of the scenarios in that program deal with very much that situation. discussion, that what are the red flags when someone might be incapacitated and a potential perpetrator might be using alcohol in order to make a victim less able to respond. So although that's not the primary focus of the Tonight program, it definitely is a piece of it. We also have a mandatory first-year education program called Alcohol EDU that all incoming students are also required to complete. And that program focuses on recognizing high-risk drinking, helping students to understand how many drinks, what that does to their body physiologically, helps them set better expectations about alcohol. So we have, for the past 2 years, required all of our incoming students to complete both of those programs.
Now, how often do cases go unreported?
Well, that's one of the things that is, definitely we knew, in kind of from very limited amounts of data, and certainly anecdotally we knew that. But this survey really provides us some solid information in that, and it is sobering. We know that on our campus, we think about a very serious incident of sexual assault when someone was physically forced and was actually had a penetrative assault, which is very serious. Even in those cases, only about 26.1% of students reported that. They had that same penetrated assault, but they happened involving their incapacitation, less than 10% of students reported that.
We're talking right now with Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of UW-Madison's University Health Services. We're looking at a new national report on sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a student, a parent, or if you work on a campus, what do you think works? What needs to change when it comes to preventing sexual assault on college campuses? What kind of programs are in place on your campus? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with Dr. Sarah Van Orman from UW-Madison's University Health Services, looking at a new national survey on sexual assault and sexual harassment on college campuses. The survey included 27 campuses around the country, including UW-Madison.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to change on college campuses? If you have a stake in the story as a parent, as a student, someone who works on a campus, what's your perspective? Call 800-642-1234. And we were talking earlier about the link, the factor of alcohol in these sexual assaults on college campuses. And given the Wisconsin drinking culture that we hear about in the state, is there any effort, do you think, to coordinate an approach addressing both those things as sort of a vector on university campuses?
I think that that's an area of emerging intersection. And, again, we want to be very clear that no one deserves to be sexually assaulted, and that a focus on victim consumption of alcohol at putting them at risk is really kind of takes the responsibility off of where it needs to lie, and that's with perpetrators. But that being said, I think that we are moving forward on our campus with a dialogue to say, how does a culture of high-risk drinking or an alcohol culture kind of set the stage to facilitate sexual assault? Again, I don't want to focus on alcohol as the only cause. There's lots of factors that are contributing, but certainly this is an important part of the solution, and I think campuses nationally are starting to kind of think about that. On our campus here, alcohol prevention and efforts are coordinated through the health service, but also in close collaboration with our Division of Student Life, our police department, our Division of University Housing, and we work very closely, and we think about these two issues as very different issues, but ones that intersect and in which we want to coordinate on. So we actually do this all the time here at UW-Madison, particularly in a state that where we do have challenges around alcohol.
We have a caller on the line now. We've got Patty with us in Door County. Patty, hi.
Hi.
What is your take on this?
Well, just listening to the talk, I totally, am on board with the fact that, yes, sexual assault should never happen. There's no excuse for it, period. But my question is, what kind of education is being directed toward these young women that put themselves in compromising situations? Is there something being done specifically to target them and say, ladies, don't be stupid. Don't put yourself in a situation that you know probably won't end well. As an example, my son, who's a sophomore at a different UW school, just the other day, he and his friends were hanging around in the dorm, and these freshman girls came up to them and said, hey, do you know where we can find a party? You know, what's being done to help these young ladies, particularly, you know, freshmen, for example, that are very naive, don't go there?
Patty, thank you so much for the call. And Dr. Van Orman, how do you draw that line or walk the line between safety education and putting the onus on women, for example?
Right, absolutely. So I appreciate the caller, and in particular, I appreciate her mentioning the issue of first-year students, because we certainly know, and the survey supported, that first-year students are at the greatest risk. They're in a new environment. They're, you know, kind of new experiences. They don't know people. So absolutely, that's an area and a group of students we want to be spending a lot of time with. I think it's very important that all students, young women and young men, understand what's happening on their campus, that they have this information, that they have good safety information, they have good information about alcohol so that they can make responsible decisions. But I also think it's important that we educate young women about the all of these things. But I think it's also really important that we spend a lot of time talking to our young men and saying, young men, don't sexually assault. That, you know, don't rape. That's probably the most important message that parents and family members and friends need to talk with them to understand. Why is it that perpetration happens? What are all those factors? And how do we engage men as part of the solution for this?
And what resources do you want people to know about, parents, staff, students, about sexual assault and to help survivors?
Yeah, we've got a lot of resources here on our campus, and I know I'm familiar with the rest of the system. I think there's a lot of resources across the system. The first is here at our campus, starting with prevention. We have our Tonight program. We also have a really excellent parent handbook that you don't have to be a UW-Madison parent to download. It's available on our website at www.uhs.wis.edu, that I, even parents of high school students, it's titled Talking to Your Student About Sexual Assault. And I think it's a wonderful resource. We know that parents who talk to their children about healthy sexuality and consent and boundaries, that those students are more likely to report if something happens to them. So that's a great resource I would mention. Here at the Health Service for Students, we have our medical and mental health services. We also have a confidential victim advocate where students can come and meet with someone if they have concerns about themselves and a friend. Finally, here on campus, we have through our offices of the Dean of Students, the offices of Equity, Diversity, and our police department are all places students can go if they want to make a report and they've experienced a sexual assault. So we think, you know, whether a student is ready to come forward and report, we want them to come forward to those offices. If they just want to talk with someone confidentially, those resources are available as well.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Sarah Van Orman, Executive Director of University Health Services, talking about a new survey of sexual assault and sexual misconduct on college campuses around the country and at UW-Madison.